Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It's October 11th. Aloha Friday. Today we look at parallels with disaster recovery from a hurricane and a wildfire. We hear from a Maui man just back from North Carolina. We sit down with the former U.S. attorney, Kenji Price, who returns home to take a job with Hawaii Pacific University. And on the record, former lawmaker and OHA trustee Peter Apo has a new book out. And remember Lost, the hit television series on ABC? Well, the new documentary rolls out at the Hawaii International Film Festival, and it shows a different side of the show. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Whether it's a wildfire or a hurricane, response and recovery is key. Today, HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel joins us to talk about the story of a Hawaii resident who has roots here and in North Carolina and has a perspective helping to get communities hit hard by disaster get back on their feet. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so tell us about this gentleman.
Yeah, so this is Kyle Ellison. He's from Kula, from upcountry Maui. And he, really from day one after the fire in Kula, has been helping his community on Maui in the recovery process, really boots on the ground, was helping fight fires, cut wood after, you know, all those trees were downed and the wind and the fires. His family had to leave, you know, evacuate their home, and had to leave their home for months after the fire. So he's been going through this recovery process himself, and he has family ties in North Carolina. He and his wife lived there for a few years, and he actually opened a paddleboard business on the river in Asheville, North Carolina, in 2015. And so he had planned a trip there this week for business before the hurricane hit. And after the hurricane, he decided to still go. And he, you know, helped his employees. He raised money for many of the small businesses there, just trying to help out however he could. And when he arrived in, he flew into Atlanta. When he arrived, he, you know, bought a chainsaw and filled his rental car with cases of water. And here's what he found when he arrived in Asheville.
All the trees are gone. There's sand beaches. Everything's covered in mud. And I think the weirdest part for me was that there's no one around. It's super deserted, and, you know, stoplights don't work. No one's at businesses. There's no tourists on the street. There aren't pedestrians. It's just empty and quiet. And then there's all these dust storms blowing around where it caked everything in mud. And then all that mud dries and all the sand. And then now when the wind blows, all that mud and sand is just like blowing everywhere. And so it has this like otherworldly, non-familiar apocalypse vibe to it that is hard to, and then everything's covered in garbage and people's personal belongings, and like up in the trees, 20 feet up in the trees, are people's backpacks and bottles of syrup that are unopened, and a couch and Polaroid pictures of someone's dog and random items from people's homes, because their homes and businesses and stores just were swept away, and it's all this detritus of people's stuff all covered in mud and sand and in the trees and littered everywhere, and you don't even know where to begin. And this extends for miles.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking, you know, people's mementos, and they don't know where it's all ended up.
Yeah, it's kind of an unimaginable amount of devastation there. You know, of course, we've been hearing about the recovery process from the Maui fires, and he talked a lot about the comparisons between the two communities facing, you know, some similar challenges, you know, economic reliance on tourism in Asheville, similarly to Maui, and how, you know, that's just really hitting the community hard. This is, you know, coming into one of their busiest seasons traditionally, and, you know, there's just nothing there. You know, and also housing crisis, you know, he talked about, you know, with so many houses just gone, you know, folks are struggling to find housing and all of those things. So he found a lot of similarities, even though the type of disaster was different. And having just gone through it on Maui, you know, Kyle said he felt compelled to share some of what he had learned with, you know, friends and fellow business people there in North Carolina.
I'll be honest, I only have the emotional capacity to deal with so many natural disasters in my brain at one time. And, you know, we're still embroiled with everything that's going on back on Maui and being very involved in that recovery. And then now this kind of gut punch of feeling like personally you're back to step zero in this other part of your life. But I realized that in reading social media posts or hearing from other friends or business, you know, small businesses, they're asking the same questions like we were asking on Maui right after the fire. You know, do we lay off our employees? Do we do, you know, is there going to be SBA funding? What about FEMA? How do I do my insurance claims? And having just gone through so much of this, I did feel this responsibility to share what we've learned in another federally declared major disaster within the last, you know, 14 months. Little things like, hey, document everything. Your urge is to clean up. I know your initial urge is to go in and clean everything. Don't do that until you take photos and video. You're going to need that for your insurance claim. So document everything. Probably not a bad idea to talk with an insurance adjuster who can maximize your policy and debris removal clauses. And because as we've seen, the insurance companies don't, they're not really equipped to pay for something of this scale all at one time. So your claim process is going to be lengthy. Take care of your mental health. This is going to be a long time. They don't have water like we didn't have water, and it's really weird again to be going down to aid hubs and dropping off cases of water and picking up cases of water and telling people, take water, you're going to need it. It's going to be a while.
Wow, pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, he said just from being there, you know, the death toll, I think, is, you know, is pretty high at this point, but he felt like it would just be hard to know even how many people didn't make it through, because so many people in this area, you know, across just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles, live in really rural areas, you know, up in the mountains, you know, may not even have addresses to search. You know, he talked about one couple, you know, a friend, you know, asked for help looking for them. And, you know, they just lived on the corner of these two rural roads, and they went and there was just nothing there. There was no trace of roads, no trace of a house, anyone had lived there. And it's just, it is, you know, pretty unimaginable. He talked about the massive cleanup effort.
One thing in fire is that it eliminates a lot of stuff. It just burns and it's gone. With a flood, everything's still there when the water recedes. It's now just an enormous mess, like a mess you can't comprehend, like dishwashers randomly sitting on tops of piles of wood that are 18 feet high. Like dishwashers should not be in the trees. That's not a normal place for dishwashers to be. And whereas when we went through the fires in Maui, it was like a lot of it was just charred and just gone and disappeared. But this is like none of it's gone. It's just, it's everywhere. And it's all covered in mud, which is probably toxic and hazardous. And, you know, houses that had asbestos-laden drywall or lead paint and all these hazardous materials. That's something that's, like, barely being talked about yet. It's just this enormous mess. You're just, like, the sense of hopelessness. It's like, how do you even clean this, like, actually, how do you clean this up? Is there even enough heavy equipment on the planet to clean this up?
Yep. Fire and water, destructive forces.
For sure. And he suggested, you know, folks helping financially at this point rather than materially if they do want to contribute, much like Maui. You know, there's just a overload of you know, clothing and food, but he said really financially is the best way to help at this point.
All right.
It was interesting to hear from him. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Catherine. We've been hearing from HBR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
So support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering master programs in finance, information systems, marketing, and travel industry management. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
I'm Anita Rao. There is a high chance that what you think you know about bisexuality is wrong.
The word doesn't mean like a 50-50 split. It doesn't mean what a lot of people think it has to mean. There's not like a litmus test.
Stories of bisexuality beyond the binary. Join us next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Former U.S. Attorney Kenji Price has returned home to Hawaii to take a job as Senior Vice President and General Counsel for Hawaii Pacific University. His background in public and private law practice includes a stint as Assistant U.S. Attorney in Eastern New York, as well as here with local firms Carl Smith Ball and Alston Hunt Floyd & Ng, which is now known as Denton's. He was most recently managing counsel at Epic Games in San Diego. He joined us in our studio yesterday afternoon to reflect back on his time in public service.
Oh, it was just an extraordinary opportunity. I mean, I grew up in Hawaii, which is well known, graduated from Mulani High School. And just to have the ability to serve in a capacity where I could really help protect Hawaii was just such a tremendous experience. I mean, heartwarming. I love public service as a general matter, but working in that capacity was really special. I had been a prosecutor in New York as a what they call an assistant United States attorney. But that was in New York. And even though New York has a very far reach, or at least those offices have a very far reach, there's nothing like doing it in your hometown where you know people. I had some familiarity with issues in Hawaii, but it was just really rewarding to do that. I would say one of the real bright spots was to be able to connect with some young people while I was in the job. There are opportunities as a U.S. attorney to connect with a lot of different constituencies. But it's really nice to connect with the young people, meaning people in high school, and just really have the ability, you hope, at least to inspire some of them to maybe pursue a career in protecting the public, in whether it's law enforcement or prosecution or something like that. But that was really special. And then, of course, the memories of just helping develop interesting cases that we really felt at the time would be impactful.
And then, gosh, I don't know, was there any particular case that you look back on now that you feel proudest of or—
You know, I tend to think so many cases are so important, and just I have a little bit of hesitance out of respect for the people who, some of whom, people who were convicted, their family members. So I won't speak to any specific case, but I'll say the subject matter, I can speak to the subject matter, meaning had the opportunity to work on obviously a lot of drug cases. We were able to try to put a dent in the drug flow of methamphetamine into Hawaii. That was really special. Of course, there are violent crime cases that are very interesting, frauds. So part of the beauty of being a U.S. attorney is the sheer scope of responsibility and the ability to touch different subject matter. Sometimes when you're lower in the ranks, your emphasis will be focused on one specific area. Like you may do fraud cases for most of your career. But as a U.S. attorney, you can touch a little bit of everything. And I really enjoyed being able to touch various subject matter and really just think, what's best for Hawaii? What do we need to do to put a dent in some of the problems in Hawaii?
I'm trying to recall if it was during your term, but I remember the ATF had put out a thing saying that they had noted a lot more guns in their cases that they were investigating. And then, you know, just this past year, we've seen so many terrible cases over on the Waianae side involving ghost guns and lots of violence. And so, I just don't know. When you see things like that, where now the guns are getting into the hands of our young people, you know, who are committing crimes. I mean, it's a terrible thing.
Well, that's what makes the job so special. You can think of it as you can be a little proactive in the job, meaning what you can do is target problems. If you see systemic issues in communities, whether it's gun violence, whether it's drugs, whether it's fraud, I mean, you name it, you can really try to develop a strategic approach to focusing resources, focusing personnel, having the conversations about what do we need to be able to be impactful. If, for example, the example you're using with firearms related crimes, violent crimes, there's possession crimes with firearms. But you can really, as a U.S. attorney, you got a lot of flexibility to say what's the most effective way to attack this problem. Often as a career prosecutor, you're given some problems. You have some leeway, of course, to investigate. But oftentimes, you know, you get directives and all of that. As a U.S. attorney, it's really a unique position. There's fair amount of flexibility there to say, what's the problem? How are we going to solve it? And the critical part of that that I really enjoyed was speaking to the law enforcement officials out there, the partners that we had with the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, as you mentioned, and just learning their perspective on where do they see issues and how can the prosecutorial function be effective in helping solve some of those problems. I wouldn't go so far as saying we solved anything. We just wanted to make some head. We wanted to push that boulder uphill.
Recently, I had the opportunity to talk to a young man. He was a Truman Scholar, and he had his sights set on becoming a federal judge, which I thought was really interesting. You know, it's like, here's a young guy going to college. He's gotten this honor, you know, and wants to go to law school. And I thought that was pretty amazing. I mean, it's not like you come across somebody every day that says, I want to be a federal judge.
Oh, well, first of all, it's impressive that he's even thinking at that level. I can't say I was always thinking at that kind of level in high school, but just to know, hey, there's a distinction between federal judges and state judges, and there's also other types of judges. But I'm impressed with the young man. I really think in that way about service, about his aspirations, particularly if he's in high school. I mean, that's really impressive. And obviously, that's just a tremendously noble undertaking to be a federal judge. I mean, it's such an impressive job, but most importantly, it just really gives people the opportunity to serve a community and do a lot of justice.
You've come back home and you're shifting over to, you know, to something else. You're going to be dealing with young minds in academia.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. This is my first foray as a full-time employee working for a university. I did a stint co-teaching a course at UH Law School a while back, but this is the first time where I'm really taking the plunge and diving into education issues. And it is absolutely a fascinating area to be in. Education-related issues are top of mind for a lot of people. But I think in Hawaii, education will always be a critical issue. And one of the things I find so rewarding about this job, or I suspect will be rewarding as time passes, is just being part of that process of empowering young people to be impactful in Hawaii and elsewhere. And to me, that's a really special thing to do. You're not, as a public official, like a prosecutor, you're directly serving the public, right? You're bringing charges on behalf of the United States government. As a educational official or in an educational administration, you're a little step removed, of course. We're a private nonprofit institution. But that said, we certainly have the ability to directly impact young people, empower them, help them aspire to do things. And then some of them stay in Hawaii and really be impactful. That's what you would hope. So I really think this is an extraordinary opportunity. I'm really excited about it.
You have two young children, so I don't know what that might have played in your decision to come back home, you know, to raise them here.
Oh, I have two young children I care very much about. Certainly, I hope that, you know, that they aim high and do extraordinary things. But my decision was a combination of a number of factors. I would say it is a unique one, and it's an experience that I'm really looking forward to. But I just hope that they aspire high and do great things over time.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you had a teacher who might have helped set you on, you know, this path that you've chosen.
Oh, geez. I've had so many good ones over the years between high school, college, law school. They left their impression in different ways, that's for sure. Can't point to one person individually that I would say this is the person who truly inspired me. I will say I come from a family where education-related issues was certainly the talk within the house at times. My mother spent a long career in education, got a PhD from UH. My sister's currently an athletic director at Emory University in Atlanta. So education has just always been sort of a part of the Price family DNA. So I'd say just the contributing factors to me landing here, they are numerous. But most importantly, I just feel blessed to be in the position and to be in a position to impact these young people and empower them.
So I do have to ask, I mean, I know you were appointed as, you know, U.S. attorney under President Trump, and, you know, he's trying to get back in office. I mean, I don't know. If he gets in, would you consider going back? You know,
you dive right into the danger zone with these tough questions. I just got hired a week ago. No, I will say right now, I'm very comfortable where I'm at. I feel very, very fortunate that the university took a chance with me and said, we'll give this local boy the opportunity to come back and work at the university. So right now, that's where I have my sights focused. And I'm really hoping to get my own education and learning the university, learning to be as effective at this job as I can.
Okay. And then is there anything in particular that you saw
with HBU that, if I'm going to switch a focus here, that this might be a good fit?
I mean, there's a number of things the university does very well. You know, it's the largest nonprofit university in the state of Hawaii. It's been a staple in this community for years. I would say that the broader mission of what educators do and the university environment is something that was very attractive to me. And to be able to be part of sort of, call it the president's leadership team, helping impact that, to me, was a unique experience and driver to make this leap. I was doing very different work before, working at Epic Games, the developer of Fortnite. What I really like about being at HBU and this opportunity is getting what I would say closer to that service of the community function. And that's not to say that private for-profit companies are not serving in their own way, but I would say certainly in an educational function or working for an educational institution, you're really closer to impacting a community directly and indirectly, because HBU graduates go all over the country, of course, if not the world. So it's really attractive just to be in that space, to be in the space of empowering people to impact communities directly and indirectly.
Well, Kenji Price, thank you so much for your time and welcome back home.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
That was former U.S. Attorney Kenji Price, who has just assumed the role as Senior Vice President and General Counsel for Hawaii Pacific University. Price also served as an Army Ranger and earned a Bronze Star Medal for his service in Iraq. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Later in the show, we'll be featuring a story about Lost, the TV series, which was filmed on location here on Oahu. And for today's Backyard Quiz, we are highlighting a successful entertainer who gained national fame as an original cast member of another long-running TV show filmed here, the original Hawaii Five-O. Do you remember Detective Kono Kalakaua, played by Gilbert Cowie? He's better known by his professional name, Zulu, which was actually a high school nickname. He was on the show for 4 years before departing the hit series in 1972. A show producers replaced Kono with local entertainer Al Harrington as Detective Ben Kokua. Zulu's film credits include A Hawaiian Eye and Gidget Goes Hawaiian. But did you know he was a talented singer, guitarist, and ukulele player? In 1971, he launched a successful nightclub career, signing a two-year contract for the price tag of $2.5 million. For today's quiz, we want to know where this gig took place. Hint, it was not in Waikiki's International Marketplace. Think you know? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HPR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com. What you
done to me? On the next Fresh Air, archive interviews with singer Sissy Houston and record-breaking baseball star Pete Rose. They both died recently. Houston was a gospel and pop singer who also backed up Aretha Franklin, Dusty Springfield, Van Morrison, Wilson Pickett, and others. She was Whitney Houston's mother. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following Science Friday.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Learn more about becoming a member and experiencing art in new ways with a redesigned membership program. HonoluluMuseum.org.
For former state representative and Office of Hawaiian Affairs trustee Peter Apo recently published a new book. It's titled For the Record, and it's a collection of articles he's written for Honolulu Civil Beat and the OHA publication Kawaiʻola since 2014. The conversation's Russell Subiono talked to Apo about the book.
Can you talk about why you decided to publish your articles as a book?
Yeah, I decided to publish it because everybody was telling me I should publish it down through the years. I actually never even thought about, you know, publishing a book. I never sort of thought of myself as that kind of a writer. I guess the best way to explain it, I've never been trained as a writer, but I liked to write. And there were a few opportunities early on, you know, this goes way back, where I started, because I was concerned about things going on in my life around community and, you know, some political stuff, cultural stuff. So I wanted to express myself, and I'm a great reader. I love to read. So I decided to start by writing letters to the editor. And then from there, it kind of bounced up. So then I started doing small articles for companies that I worked for, or I was a consultant to, that dealt with cultural subjects. That's when I started to write for Civil Beat. And then, of course, when I was with OHA. So the Civil Beat articles and the OHA articles kind of would cover the same sort of time period. You know?
In your book's preface, you share that you left Hawaii for college in 1957 and you returned after 18 years in 1975. You know, the changes that you observed when you returned, did they in any way influence your interest in writing or in writing these articles?
Brother, you just hit the button. I left in 1957, and here's what was going on. First of all, my childhood started with Pearl Harbor and the bombing. And that was I was born in 1938. So, you know, I was raised during the time, you know, Second World War, Korea, et cetera, when even though Hawaiians were a little bit restless about the fact that we were struggling to try to get some kind of reconciliation on what we considered to be the illegal overthrow, and Hawaii becoming part of the United States. But during that war period, families then, at least, you know, the families that I knew, because of the war, we were sort of heavily Americanized within the framework of the wars that were going on. But even more than that, my parents, who represented pretty much a lot of the parents from that era, were really concerned that their children would be educated, would be able to compete, would be able to take advantage of what they considered to be great opportunities in being an American. So I was raised during the period where it was pretty cool to be an American, even though there was this undercurrent at the time of this need to reconcile the annexation. But that was kind of tampered down. I don't come back home to Hawaii till 1975, at least not to live. I came back a couple of times just to visit. In 75, here's what's going on. Protect Hauʻolawe is beginning to explode. And simultaneously, the Hokulea is also exploding. And so to come back into that situation where Hawaiians were rising, they were kind of waking up, and I absolutely was blown away by all of it. And I dove into it both feet, just really, really got involved. And there was a period where I served as chair for the Protect Kahoʻolawe Ohana and very involved in a lot of the Hokulea activities at the time, rediscovering our Hawaiianness.
The very first article you share in your book was also your first article that you wrote for Civil Beat back in January of 2015. It's entitled The Hawaiians, a Divided People. And since the publication of that article, I feel like we've seen more unity among Hawaiians, especially when you look at something like the 2019 TMT protests. Do you feel that progress has been made to be less divided?
I feel that there's a rise in feeling a sense of responsibility. I do feel that. But we are divided in the sense that there is no central authority that can navigate and speak on behalf of all Hawaiians. Sometimes Hawaiians come out and speak, well, you know, we Hawaiians feel like this. There is no one who can really speak for all Hawaiians because although OHA has been around for what, since 1980, right? OHA's job was supposed to be to organize Hawaiians to take a look and try to create a sense of nationhood to go back and pretty much put us on the right track. And it's not a bad thing. They've become more of a granting agency, you know, helping private nonprofits. And they've kind of strayed away from what they were specifically intended to pursue, which is AIA, self-determination. With that, in today's world, what you say is somewhat true. But because there is, and OHA has, in my opinion, you know, really struggling to try to become a center of gravity and an authoritative body, you know, to speak on behalf of Hawaiians. But you cannot really say that. A lot of Hawaiians don't agree with OHA. So if you were to paint the structure of the Hawaiian community and just take the various organizations, Hawaiian civic clubs, et cetera, and you go around and you talk, you're going to see a lot of disagreement on a number of things, not all cultural. So I think you're partly right, but for the most part, we're still a long, long ways from being organized and being able to speak with one voice, or to even be able to say there's any organization or person who's able to represent us. And I guess what I'm saying is, in my opinion, the period that we're going through or have been through and still going through requires extraordinary leadership, extraordinary. And we've yet to come up with that kind of leadership that's really able to pull us together.
In ancient times, the king would have served that role, or any of the monarchs would have served that role, but we don't have that today.
You know what I think happened? After annexation, when they were restructuring the land, the ali'i, you know, they got their share of lands, and then the rest of the land was left to the makainana, the common people. The ali'i, who were the authorities, who had the authority to rule, were turned into, and it was, it's a good thing, Kamehameha schools were turned into private trusts based on the land. But the political leadership was not there. They never intended to be political organizations. So that part of the leadership disappeared. And so the makainana were kind of left to fend for themselves and to figure out things for themselves. So there was this huge leadership void when the separation of ali'i from makainana happened. And we are still, as makainana, getting back to our beginning of the conversation, struggling to find that center of gravity and how we're able to navigate that among ourselves.
Many of your articles look at internal issues amongst Hawaiians, but you also look at external issues like Hawaiians' relationship with other ethnicities living in Hawaii and how politics and events outside of Hawaii influence Hawaiians. Another article that caught my eye was published in December of 2016 entitled, "Can Hawaiians Keep Their Aloha in a New Global Order?" When we think about political events happening on the continent and their influence here, how do we keep our aloha?
Well, you know, I think we're kind of okay on that in this sense. The idea of aloha really got adopted by the other races that came, in a sense. So that anybody that is raised here, I think the majority of the population, especially those that are in, you know, third, fourth, fifth generation immigrants that came in, you know, Japanese, Chinese, the aloha thing perpetuated by Hawaiians had its roots in this historical perspective. Hawaiians were colorblind. So when all these different races began to come to Hawaii and immigrate for plantations and all of that, it didn't matter to Hawaiians whether you're Japanese, Filipino, whatever. If they liked you, they liked you. And so all these intermarriages started to happen. So today, when you look across the landscape, what do you see? You see Hawaiian Chinese, Hawaiian Filipino, Hawaiian this, Hawaiian that. So everybody kind of sense, even if they're not by blood, I think by the fact that they that live here, kind of adopts, you know, within their hearts this sense of aloha. So it become pretty much a very strong, basic, community, widespread attitude. You see this every day when you people that will let you in, traffic, you know, stuff like that. You know, little, what I call random acts of aloha. So I think the aloha thing is doing okay here.
Can you share with our listeners where they can get your book?
Locally, Native Books. That's the one downtown. And then the one in Kaukaku, Namea Hawaii Native Books. And Amazon, of course. Amazon's got a bunch.
Peter Alpo, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
We've been hearing from former OHA trustee Peter Alpo. He was talking to HRR's Russell Subiono about his new book, For the Record. It's actually a collection of articles that he has published over the past decade. We'll have a link to more information on our website after the show. And now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we jogged your memory about Detective Kono Kalakaua, one of the original Hawaii Five-O characters from 1968, played by Hilo native Gilbert Kaui. Fans probably know him best by his professional name, Zulu. He acted in four seasons, but his character was written off the show in 1972. By this time, the old Five-O had captured the attention of American TV viewing audiences. Producers had come up with just the right mix of murder and mayhem taking place in urban settings and beautiful Hawaii backdrops. Although he was no longer on TV, Zulu was able to launch into a successful nightclub career. He signed a multi-million dollar contract in 1971, appearing at the Sesebon showroom at the Pagoda Hotel and Restaurant just around the corner from HPR. And that was the answer that we were looking for. Zulu was also a headliner for several years at Duke Kahanamoku's in the International Marketplace in Waikiki. We had no winners today, but that was our quiz. And if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
After cleaning up after these two big hurricanes and making sure people are as safe as they can be, right at the top of the list, getting cell service back.
I'm still getting messages from loved ones looking for their loved ones, not only Canton, but the region, because I can't place a phone call.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, cellular coverage in the aftermath of the hurricanes, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for HPR comes from Chamber Music Hawaii, presenting pianist John Nakamatsu, performing music of Beethoven and Schumann, October 19th at Doris Duke Theater. Tickets at chambermusichawaii.org.
I believe it's been 20 years since the first season of the hit ABC show Lost. A new documentary playing at the Hawaii International Film Festival takes viewers down memory lane and features interviews with cast members, showrunners, and Hawaii's own Ryan Ozawa. The film is called Getting Lost. It raised over $250,000 by crowdfunding, reaching their initial goal within 24 hours. For any other documentary, that would have been the headline. But last year, new allegations surfaced about a toxic writer's room, one that some writers and cast members allege was racist and sexist. The makers of the documentary decided to incorporate the good, the bad, and the ugly into their film. Resident Lost fan and HPR producer Maddie Bender recently spoke to two of the people who made Getting Lost, director and producer Taylor Morden and his wife, producer Emily Claire Morden. Taylor starts us off.
I actually wanted to tell this story for the past 10 years, and it kept feeling too soon. There was this period after Lost ended where people liked to make fun of Lost. It was the butt of a lot of jokes. And, you know, I didn't like that as a fan. And as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, it seemed too soon, and I didn't want to fight with that. And nostalgia sort of flows in these 20-year waves. And so about 10, 8, 7, 6, 5 years ago, it was like, when am I going to do that Lost documentary? Well, if we finish it in 2024, that'll be the 20th anniversary. So that's just enough time. in between seasons one and two is when I got into it. I know we didn't watch it in real time, but I got into it because of the DVDs. I lived way outside of town, drove half an hour to go rent a DVD. I got the first disc, and that first disc of Lost has the pilot, a regular episode, a Kate episode called Tabula Rasa, and then the John Locke episode Walkabout, which was the episode for me that redefined what television could be. And I immediately drove back into town and got the next disc and was hooked.
I'll get you on a plane back to Sydney on our dime. It's the best I'll get.
No, I don't want to go back to Sydney. Look, I've been preparing for this for years. Just put me on the bus right now. I can do this.
No, you can't.
Hey, don't you walk away from me. You don't know who you're dealing with. Don't ever tell me what I can't do, ever. This is destiny. This is my destiny. I'm supposed to do this, damn it. Don't tell me what I can't do. Don't tell me what I can't.
A ton of people watched it after, for sure. Especially now it's become multi-generational. So there's a lot of people our age, now that we're the olds, who are showing it to their kids, you know, because it's been 20 years. So the people who were dating when they were watching Lost have 18-year-old kids now. And there is this different perception of the show. Like, one of the big things about it was having to wait every week and talking about it. Everybody was watching the same thing at the same time in real time. And all the people who watched it after, no offense, but you missed out on that community and that conversation. And then also, you didn't have to wait 5 months to find out what was in the hatch or what happened when Juliet hit the bomb or any of these things that we all, as a community of Lost fans, like, man, that's what we did all summer, is just talk about what was, and we would rewatch the other seasons, you know, like I saw season one 6 times before season 6 was over, because every year we'd watch it over and over again looking for clues.
I think when you guys started, you really had this vision of it being a story about the fandom and kind of centering on that, and not knowing who from the cast that we would be able to get to sit down for an interview. And it just sort of started to snowball. You know, you interview one person and they understand what you're trying to do. And they're like, oh, I know so-and-so. You should really talk to them about this. And it just kept growing from there. And then that's when I came on board as well to help out. And the crowdfunding really helped launch it to kind of a whole new level, because then we had the ability to kind of go and do some of these interviews in New York, on the East Coast, that otherwise we just wouldn't have had the budget as, you know, indie filmmakers to really do that. So it was very exciting to see the Lost fan community really come behind this project and provide support to allow us to make it what it became.
It's something that's not lost on the viewer, the fact that some of these interviews with former cast members are done on Oahu because they are still living here. And I think that is something that gets addressed, both like Hawaii as a place, but also just the experience that these cast members had, like what a connection they made that kept them here for now 2 decades.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts, is getting to sit down with Daniel Day Kim and Henry Ian Cusick, who still live here and have lived here since the show was being filmed, and just to hear them talk about this place and how much it means to them. And then in other interviews with people who lived here when they were filming but have since moved on, to hear them reminisce about how much this place means to them was so wonderful. Makes me want to move here.
And, you know, some days it's go walk on the beach with Daniel Day Kim and Henry Ian Cusick and talk about how beautiful Hawaii is while being in Hawaii. It's crazy how cool that is as a fan of the show. And then, you know, there's the 9 months of sitting in a dark basement editing the movie that we don't talk about, that's way less glamorous and way less fun. When we started, like Emily said, we didn't know we'd get in touch with any of these people. We were like, it's going to be about the fans and we're going to make this documentary and it's going to be cool, because it was a cool time. And then you talk to Jorge Garcia and he's like, well, let me get the word out to the people. And then all of a sudden, Josh Holloway's interested, and Michael Emerson, and he calls Terry O'Quinn. And by the time that gets out, Evangeline Lilly's on board and Maggie Grace. And you're just like, I guess we're just making Lost now. There was, yeah. There was a day when we had Francois Chow, who plays the doctor with many names from the Dharma Initiative that does the videos. But we did an interview with him, and we asked him, you know, very nervously, like, what would you think about maybe putting the lab coat back on and we're going to do some new Dharma videos throughout the movie, as, you know, in place of like a narrator or something else as a story mechanism. And he was totally on board, and he was like, you know what? I still have the lab coat.
Okay, here we go. Can you hold that a little more? As Lost continued to be a massive success, the writers knew that they wouldn't be able to keep telling the story of the survivors of the crash of Oceanic Flight 815 without knowing when the show would end.
And we're on stage, you know, with a green screen, holding up cue cards, and he's doing the character from Lost, and we're just looking at each other like, I guess we're just filming Lost now? Which is the craziest feeling as someone for whom it was my favorite television show for 5 years.
Visually, this was so striking to me when you interviewed all these actors and cast members. The couches they were sitting on were so marvelous. How was that planned? How was that coordinated?
That's complete accident.
Are you serious?
It's you know.
By the third couch, I was like, this has to be intentional.
I mean, Andrea Gabriel's couch.
That's just her couch.
I know, that's her couch. Maggie Grace, that was in a studio. It was a lovely couch. I really feel like with this movie, we got lucky. Like, we would book these studios just off of some pictures on a website, you know, going to New York, going to LA, booking a studio. Got to get these people in for an interview. You show up and you just have to make it work with what's in the room. And somehow I really feel like we got lucky and things worked out, because so-and-so, you know, shows up in a certain color top and it's like, oh, that's perfect. We'll put you on this couch and it just works. And I don't know.
Yeah. Evangeline Lilly, there was this great blue couch in this cool studio. Man, if she had been wearing a blue top, I don't know what we would have done. Love a good couch question. That's our first... What's up with the couches?
But I appreciate the couches in this movie.
Were there any people you spoke to who you weren't expecting to play as large a role as they did?
For me, it was Michael Emerson. Mm. I mean, I could just watch his whole interview just by itself, because he gave us so much, and just the way he speaks is enthralling.
When he laughs, it's my favorite thing in the world. I left in a lot of people laughing in the movie just because... Especially him, his character doesn't laugh in the show, and if he does, it's creepy, and he's a scary guy. But in real life, he could not have been nicer. It was one of the most surreal interviews we've ever done. New York City, where, you know, it's busy, hectic. We show up at his building. He comes down, helps us carry equipment up. He's like, has pastries set out, and he's just the sweetest man. And then you start talking to him, and he's funny, and he's charming, and he's witty, and it's just like, you're not a villain at all, yeah. Even though every role he plays is scary, creepy guy.
As we're talking, I feel like we keep bringing up the joy, and it is like a very joyous documentary. But there is a tension, I think, with the later part of the documentary when you get into the onset allegations, which came out just like this past year. So at what point in filming did you hear about these allegations? And then what was the meeting of the minds like to figure out how are we going to address this?
Well, we almost quit.
Yeah, it was pretty tough.
We had been working on the movie for a year and a half before that came out. And I forget, somebody gave us a heads up and said, there's an article coming, there's a book coming, and you're going to want to read it. When it came out, we had a meeting, the producers and I, about just, should we not finish this movie? Have we contributed to the problem by building up these people and doing exactly what the book and the article lines out, which is you put people up on a pedestal and then they can do no wrong, and then they're getting away with things that they shouldn't and all this. And there was this real moral dilemma of, is it okay to even finish this movie that we've spent now a year and a half on, and there's another year to go? And they say it in the documentary, but we were defending these people in public, like at a bar. Somebody's like, oh, you like Lost, that show sucks, and the ending is stupid, and everyone who likes it is an idiot. And we would get up and almost get into fights about it and say, no, 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 you're wrong, and here's why, for years. And then this book comes out, and you're like, oh, the people I'm defending were contributing to these toxic environments and really negatively impacting other people's lives. How do I reconcile that? Meanwhile, we're making a documentary about how great those people, I mean, not directly, but the show, how great it is. It was really tough to get past that. And it took us a long time. We took a break.
I mean, one thing that did help us to move forward was being able to talk with Javi, one of the writers, you know, who was a person harmed in the situation. And he wanted to actually talk on camera and share his story. And we felt that that, you know, is now part of the story of Lost, and it needs to be part of the conversation. So we felt like it was important to keep going and, you know, just tell the full story of this show.
I feel like in a show that is about all these multitudes and is about the general ambiguity you're left with when you look at all the good in the world and all the evil in the world, surely a documentary about that show can contain multitudes as well.
Yeah. If I were a smarter filmmaker, I would have known that going in. Mm-hmm. But someone in the doc says it, it's like, it is almost a perfect parallel for the show of Lost, because it's about all these flawed people trying to find redemption, and you see flashbacks and you see these mistakes in people's past, and you find out whether or not they can be reconciled, and it's all open to interpretation. And that's true in real life too. It's like silly to be like, it's just like in the show, but it is kind of just like in the show.
We've been hearing from Taylor Morden and Emily Claire Morden. They were talking with The Conversation's Maddie Bender. Getting Lost will be playing tonight, October 11th, at Consolidated Theaters Kahala at 8:15 p.m. Tickets are sold out, but standby may be available. The film's producers say they have plans to screen the documentary in Canada and in London before releasing it on digital platforms by the end of the year. Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, who wants to be the next University of Hawaii president? We plan to hear from the two candidates on the shortlist. Give us some feedback. Call 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple or on our website. Russell Subiano, Lillian Song, Maddie Bender all helped to produce the show, along with Tori DeJournay and Savannah Harriman-Pote. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up The Conversation.